Hello and welcome to Banfield, inside Wyoming's Grand Teton National Park, next to a dry riverbed on the border of the Bridger-Teton National Forest. There is a tiny little shrine that is tucked beneath those giant watchful mountains. It's cross, and it's made of stones, and there's a handful of budding flowers there as well. And it marks the spot where Gabby Petito's body was found. It was the handiwork of her stepfather, after sheriff's deputies led him to the scene. And when Jim Schmidt described what he went through to create that tribute, there was deafening silence in the room. You're going to hear some highlights from part two of that interview with Dr. Phil, most notably what Gabby's family would like to see happen to Brian Laundrie. But first to Florida, where News Nation's Brian Enten has been tracking this case closer than anyone. He is outside the Laundrie home. Brian, there's been this breaking news again involving that silver Mustang that has been featured throughout this entire saga. Now we're learning about a police report regarding it being parked in that reserve. All sorts of words like abandoned vehicle are popping up, and what the civic code allows in terms of deeming something an abandoned vehicle. And all I can think of, Brian, is that it's starting to really put into question an already questionable timetable of the Laundries. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, so we got this police report today and we were anxious to get it. And I'm not sure if you've seen the police report, but like three chunks of it are totally blacked out. So we still don't have a lot of answers. They're redacting pretty much everything we request because of the FBI investigation. But you mentioned the Mustang. Let me show you the Mustang while we talk about it, because it's right here in the front yard next to the camper, the silver Mustang there. What we have learned is that, according to the parents, to their attorney, Brian Laundrie drove this Mustang over to the reserve when he went allegedly on this hike and left the Mustang there. That is why police put this abandoned car notice on the Mustang. And according to the attorney for the parents then returned to the reserve several days later to pick up the Mustang and brought the Mustang here back to the house.
Okay, I'm sort of sorting through all the documents, and that police report, I've got a copy of it right here as well. You're right, there's a lot. All this is black. You can't read any of it. But what you can read is the very top. It says abandoned vehicle way up at the top to the right of the police shield. And it says the incident location, 6968 Reiterstown Road. And I think that's the parking lot of the reserve. But what was more interesting, Brian, is we pulled up the actual civic code for abandoned vehicles. And it's a bit dry. But bear with me, Brian. I want to read it. And I want to show it to our viewers because there's something that really kind of stands out. The Florida legislature has prescribed procedures which may be followed by municipalities for the proper removal and disposal of abandoned and unlawfully parked vehicles. Later in the code, though, I found this little clause that sounded awfully curious with regard to Brian's car. Any vehicle which is left upon public property for a period of, wait for it, 5 days or longer shall be presumed to be abandoned. The rightful owner of such vehicle may rebut this presumption of abandonment. So that's what stood out to me, Brian Enten. 5 days or longer, that car would have had to be parked there in order to be deemed abandoned, if that's in fact what played out. It's hard to tell because, again, let me remind our viewers, with this case, this is usually what we get. It's hard to see the details. But, Brian, this has to call into question this entire story that the Laundrie family in that house behind you has told about when they said Brian went on a hike and didn't come back, and then when they revised it to say it was one day longer.
Well, you've got it in front of you. I've got it printed out in the truck, but you look at it since you've got the date in front of you. I believe it's September 14th. Is that correct? Around 2:42 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Is that what it says at the top?
If we can, yeah.
On the police report, I mean.
Timeline for, oh, for that. Okay, so for the police report, yes. Let me just check it real quickly. It says, yes.
Yeah,
it
look
says
at the top of it.
2:42 p.m., and it's on September 14th. So that would be the Tuesday.
Right. So it is interesting with the timeline. How long was the Mustang actually there? And what you just read, the law says that it would have had to be there 5 days before they could you know, issue this notice. Well, according to the timeline that we've got, which is constantly changing and almost impossible to keep track of because the family keeps changing the story, according to that timeline, it would appear that the Mustang wasn't there for 5 days.
So, you know, I'm going to ask the control room to put the timeline back up because it's so curious as you fill in the missing blanks there. It's very interesting to see that the new timeline that the laundries have now, you know, given us starts on September 13th. It's the new date. It's no longer September 14th that they said he just went off on a hike. They now say it's September 13th that he went off on a hike and didn't come home. And then you'll see September 14th, they say nothing. And on September 15th, they say nothing. And on September 16th, they say nothing. And on September 17th, they finally report Brian missing. And I believe it was you in the evening hours, maybe at 9 or 10 o'clock Eastern, you broke the news. So it took all day Friday. That's a full 5 days that they said nothing, but there's also 5 days that the car would have had to be there, and yet it was picked up on Wednesday. So am I to think now that September 13th is bogus? That car was over at that reserve at least maybe 2 days earlier, maybe three?
Well, and let me tell you something else interesting, Ashley. So originally, and again, it's changed so many times, but originally, the attorney was telling us that the Mustang was picked up on Tuesday, the silver Mustang right here. What was so strange about Luis, my cameraman, and what we were thinking about this? We've been out at the house every day at that time and now, getting video every single day of the driveway. So we went back and looked through our video, and they initially said they picked up the Mustang on Tuesday, but our video didn't show that. There was no Mustang in the driveway that Tuesday. It wasn't until Wednesday that the Mustang appeared. So that initial storyline really didn't even make sense based on what we were seeing with our own eyes outside of the laundry home.
So pop up that timeline again, if I can ask our control room, because, you know, Tuesday was the day they said he went off on his hike. You wouldn't go and take his car on the day he's gone into the reserve. So let's just imagine for a moment it was the next day. It was the Wednesday, September 15th. Well, even then, Brian, if they're bringing that Mustang home on September 15th, the ordinance says it's not an abandoned car unless it's been there 5 days. Well, go back 3 days, and that's the day he apparently goes hiking. So go back two more days, and Yahtzee, what day do you land on? September 11th, the day that she is announced and reported as missing.
So it seems there are two things. Number one, they're still not getting the story straight and there's something we don't know and the timeline's going to change again, or there's something nefarious going on. Or number two, did the police make a mistake issuing this notice, not realizing that they had to wait a full 5 days?
And you know what? You're a great reporter, and you've got this to work with. I'm holding it up right now. If there's a mistake in it, you and I cannot tell because that giant black line, there's no getting through it. Okay, I'm going to switch gears for a minute if I can, Brian. First of all, let me ask you if there's been any action. Have you seen them at all today? Has there been anything happening at the house?
No action at the house. The only thing was this morning they got a box delivered and Christopher Laundrie, the dad, came right to the screened-in door, received the box. We could barely even get a shot because it was so shady. He didn't come past the screen and went back in. That has literally been it for the entire day here.
Well, I wonder if located in that box was an invitation, a giant, giant invitation, because the word has also broken today, Brian, that Christopher Laundrie, Brian's dad, has been invited, okay, to help search for his son in the Carlton Preserve. So I just, you know, couldn't quite figure that out because, to my knowledge, he is not an expert, outdoorsman or you know, search and rescue operator. What on earth could Christopher Laundrie possibly do to help all of the bloodhounds, all of the mud trackers, all of the heat seeking, all of the professional searchers, and what they've been doing for the last 3 weeks?
Well, I think the thought is that Christopher Laundrie has been out at this reserve before with his son, and perhaps he might know the areas and be able to show the FBI and the police officers the areas where Brian may have frequented. I think that's the thought sort of going on behind the scenes. But yeah, it was interesting. This all came down within the last couple of hours. Again, sort of a bombshell from Bertolino, the attorney. He sends out the text message, and it says that police have asked Christopher Laundry, Brian's dad, to assist them in the search over at the reserve. Apparently, this was supposed to happen today. For whatever reason, it did not happen today. So we immediately, our follow-up question was, well, is it going to happen tomorrow? And he said they're still waiting to hear back from police.
So since the, you know, minutia and itsy bitsy tiny facts can be so important, you mentioned it. I'm going to put it up on the screen. It's Stephen Bertolino, that lawyer's statement about this business about Mr. Laundry now being invited to help them search. I hope he has good muck boots. It says this: Chris Laundry was asked to assist law enforcement in their search for Brian at the preserve today. Since the preserve has been closed to the public, Chris has not been able to look for Brian in the only place Chris and Roberta believe Brian may be. Unfortunately, Northport police had to postpone Chris's involvement, but Chris and Roberta are hopeful there will be another opportunity to assist. I know I've asked you this before, Brian, but I'm going to ask it again because I still don't get it. If Chris and Roberta Laundry truly believe that their son Brian is somewhere in that swamp, then why on earth did they take the car away? Why didn't they think when he comes out, he's going to need a vehicle to come home?
And why haven't they come out of the house for the last several weeks and pleaded with the public for help? And why haven't they shown up to the swamp? That statement said the swamp has been closed. That's not entirely true because there have been days they've reopened the reserve. We've been out there when the gates are open. It's massive. It's 24,000 acres. If you wanted to get in some way, you could probably find a way. But instead, they've been in the house and they don't come out.
I think you're right. I have two boys, and if one of them was gone for 10 minutes and I thought there was a problem, I would tear everybody away in front of me to break any line and search for my son if he really was missing. Okay, Brian, when we come back, I want to go over some of those things that the Petito family told to Dr. Phil. I just, like, again, just heart sick for them. But what poignant discussion they had. So stay where you are. If you and Luis could just get a couple more shots of the home behind you when we come back, what exactly the Petito family would like to see on the capture of Brian Laundry. You might be surprised.
When they were out and they started their grid search of the area that she was eventually found in, they had to call the search off at the end of the day because of the weather. And as the weather, you know, the rain and snow started to break, there was a rainbow across the sky that stopped. And it stopped right over the area where they eventually found her the next day. And where it stopped, there was a bald eagle that was flying in that area. And the search and rescue team said, that's a sign we're going to find her tomorrow.
When we were coming home from the Northport press conference, there was a double rainbow. I've never seen a double rainbow, and it went from one side to the other. It was absolutely beautiful. I actually took a picture of it, and I sent it right away to Nikki to say that this is a sign. Then when we flew up to New York from Florida, there was another rainbow right over Wilmington,
where she used to live.
We saw four rainbows on the flight up.
So those were the signs, Brian Enten, that the Petito and Schmidt family said that they've seen since their loved Gabby left them. And it's pretty heartfelt. There were signs behind you as well of Gabby Petito's love in the way of flowers. Any more flowers arriving?
There have been more flower deliveries today. Several, you look up by the door, you can see they're still out there. I mentioned the parents have come and gotten other packages and food deliveries that have arrived, but they've really just let the flowers be. And this arrangement over here that we showed you yesterday is also still here, Ashley. There's a couple more bouquets here that also arrived today. People really just wanting to make a statement here outside the house, the laundry house, because, you know, this is where Gabby lived for quite some time also, and people wanting to send that message to Brian's parents.
So I remember last night you showing us the you know, the dirty laundry basket that someone has put out at those flowers. I'm not going to go there tonight, Brian, because the flowers are, I think, a really telling tribute to Gabby. And there's somebody, you know, an onlooker taking pictures even at this time of night, 10:20 p.m. Eastern time. There's somebody there snapping pictures of the flowers. Here's why I think flowers are so important to talk about right now, Brian. When Jim Schmidt, Gabby's stepdad, was out west and ultimately received the terrible news, he was led out by sheriff's deputies to the place where Gabby's body was ultimately found. And he talked about what he did to pay tribute to that young lady. And listen, get your tissues. I want to play for you that moment. Take a look.
I laid the cross directly over where her torso was. And I was told the direction in which her head was laying, and that's where I placed two flowers in the ground right there.
You gave him a lot of credit for doing that. I don't know if I could have done that.
Yeah. Yeah. He sent us a picture of it.
Yeah.
We bawled.
It had to be tough.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. But I knew what...
He knew he could handle it.
I knew what I was accepting when I took it on.
To be clear, Brian, has there ever been a mention from Mr. and Mrs. Laundrie about Gabby?
No. There have been no mentions. Obviously, the attorney has made a couple of statements, but the Laundries have never come out. And just you playing that soundbite from Gabby's stepdad, I was thinking about this last night when we were talking about it, you know, that he went out there by himself for the most part with some extended family members to search for Gabby. And he was the one who had to be there when she was found. And I was just thinking about how difficult that must have been because he was in many ways alone there while the rest of the family was waiting back for news. And just, I mean, I can't imagine what he must have gone through, you know, in that moment.
You don't have to because he has told Dr. Phil exactly what he went through, what he saw, and he very clinically detailed for not only the rest of the Petito family, but for the rest of us who've really just been so upset and saddened by the mystery, exactly how he found or how it was described that they found Gabby's body next to where the tent might have been, the firing. Let me let Jim Schmidt tell you in his own words. Take a look.
So the dispersed campgrounds are basically just open land where anybody can go and camp, and where their van was basically alongside like a creek bed, and now it's just a little bit, you know, a few tributary streams running through, but obviously in the springtime with the snow melt, it's much, much larger. So you have to cross over this creek bed, this rock area, and go through these tributaries, and then once you get on the other side, it's just some trees, you know, sparsely placed throughout, and a lot of sagebrush, a lot of low brush. And it's actually on the borderline of the Bridger-Teton National Forest, and it was about maybe 40 feet away from where the Grand Teton National Park starts. And it was in an area where there was a few trees.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? I want them to keep rolling that. I was just being told they're going to cut that sound short. This is exactly... Can I ask the control room to keep rolling that sound bite? He's just about to describe what the sheriff's told him. Can the control room tell me? Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, Brian. Let's roll that again. Let's at least continue it.
So the dispersed campgrounds are basically just open land where anybody can go and camp, and where their van was basically alongside like a creek bed. And now it's just a little bit, you know, a few tributary streams running through, but obviously in the springtime with the snow melt, it's much, much larger. So you have to cross over this creek bed, this rock area, and go through these tributaries. And then once you get on the other side, it's just some trees, you know, sparsely placed throughout, and a lot of sagebrush, a lot of low brush. And it's actually on the borderline of the Bridger-Teton National Forest, and it was about maybe 40 feet away from where the Grand Teton National Park starts. And it was in an area where there was a few trees, and there was the remnants of a fire ring there, and you could see where those rocks had been moved to make the fire ring. There was a clearing where I would assume, knowing I have a similar tent, where I would place my tent, and that opening would face out overlooking the mountain range. And her body was found, I guess it would be in front of a tent, or if that's what was there, or just in front of the fire ring.
So, Brian, I think what is so incredibly fascinating is that they have that much detail from the scene of where her body was found. But also, Brian, I don't know if you caught during Dr. Phil's interview, they said that this was only about a 5 or 10 minute walk from where that vehicle was parked on the road, where that white van was parked on the road, where so many of the YouTubers have said they saw it.
Yeah, and that goes back to this critical clue that came in from the Bethune family, those bloggers who, you know, we basically suspected all along that their clue is what led the FBI to Gabby's body. And now that's becoming crystal clear. You know, they caught the van on their dash cam video, realized it, alerted the FBI, and it turns out that is what led them to that specific area.
So, Brian, I want to play something else from this interview that they conducted with Dr. Phil. And I think this is the essential question, especially the people that you're encountering down there, how angry they are towards the Laundrie family, how angry they are towards Brian, the messages that they've left, the threatening words that they've had for the Laundrie family. But then you ask the Petitos, who of anybody have the right to be more angry than anyone. And their words are way more measured, but extraordinarily to the point. And I want you to listen to this comment that they made about how they would like Brian Laundrie to be found. Take a look.
I just hope he's found. I really do. Like,
he'll be found.
No, I mean, like, alive.
I want to look him in the eyes.
The more he runs, the more he hides, the less he could try to say it was a mistake or he had nothing to do with it.
I want to see him in a jail cell for the rest of his life where he's an outdoorsman. Being in that concrete cell and he can't go see those trees and hug those, you know, and smell the fresh air like that.
As an outdoorsman, that would be in a cement box.
You know, Brian Enten, they are clear. They want him caught alive. They want to see justice. They want to see him imprisoned. And they want to take away the one thing that we have all learned about Brian Laundrie. We don't know much, but we do know this. He loves the outdoors. He spends so much of his time in the outdoors. Even when he was living in the yellow house behind you, he was always going camping. And that's what they want to take away from him. I suppose it's not surprising to hear that from where you stand.
It is not, and you mentioned their words are just so powerful, and I just stand here outside the Laundrie's house knowing that they're inside, wondering, you know, did they see this interview? Are they processing it? Does this have something to do with them now saying they want to go out and help search? You know, obviously we don't have any of the answers because they don't come out and talk, but you have to wonder if they're in there with the TV on, and are they seeing all of this?
Right. Well, if they are seeing it, there's one more thing that Joe Petito would probably like them to know. And certainly Joe Petito wants everyone watching to know that he doesn't want Gabby's death to be in vain, that he wants something good to come of this, some meaning to come of this. And for that, he has started a foundation. It's called the Gabby Petito Foundation.org, if you want to look for it. And just listen to the grace of this man. As he discusses the foundation, take a listen.
We're starting the Gabby Petito Foundation. I mean, there's already been a lot of good things that has come from everybody searching for Gabby and the media being so good. Starting to have older missing people in terms of cases brought back onto, you know, to the forefront, which is awesome. I mean, we got an email from people that are in bad relationships, and it's because it's inspired by Gabby. So, like, we want to start this foundation to help to make sure people like Gabby or people who are in similar situations as Gabby don't end up them.
How about that for grace? He wants others to benefit where he could not. Brian Enten, excellent work. As per usual, please thank Luis, your photojournalist, for doing a great job. A very long day for both of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Ashley.
Still to come, two people who know everything about hunting down fugitives, because that's what they do for a living. plus the unmistakable characteristics that Brian Laundry just cannot hide. Welcome back to our special coverage of the manhunt for Brian Laundry. Almost every day, the Laundry family seems to switch up their stories, disclose new information, and then admit that some of their memories are, I don't know, a little bit foggy. Basically telling us that everything we thought we knew about the case is kind of wrong. And that makes it really, really hard to follow leads and conduct searches and find Brian Laundry. So what do you do when you're faced with shifting timelines and unreliable sources? I'm joined by Richard Frankel, a former FBI special agent in charge who has led several criminal investigations and undercover operations. And Gil Alba, he is a former New York City Police Department major case squad detective who now works as a private investigator helping families in missing persons cases similar to that of Gabby Petito. Thank you both. Gil, I want to start with you.
Thank you.
First of all, this news today, I just don't understand this. Authorities are now inviting Mr. Laundry, Christopher Laundry, Brian Laundry's dad, to come and give them a hand searching in the swamp where they've been for over 2.5 weeks. What do you make of that?
I've been working for families maybe 20 years with these cases, and I've learned as a private investigator, different than the police department and law enforcement, and I've spoken to families on these, they are not going to tell the truth. Why do you want the father to go show you where his son is going to be? Do you think he actually wants to show you something like that? And they never mentioned Gabby at all. They never mentioned, put flyers out, go help us find something. They never did anything for her whatsoever and did everything for their son to cover up for their son. So nothing that they say do I believe, including those dates that they give. Either the car is stranded there. None of that do I believe. But I want law enforcement to, because when they talk to law enforcement, when law enforcement talks to the family, they actually believe what they're trying to tell them. And really, because they sound normal, they're really throwing them off and going to different directions. Can you see that father going and showing the police where they were and where he may be? I don't really see that. He may show them where they were last.
I think a lot of people feel the same way you do. I mean, we're all a bit confounded, Gil, by this notion that why are they spending so much money in the place where they just assume the parents, why would they want, to put the police on to their scent? But Richard, let me try something else here, because everyone who's watching also kind of wants to help. they want to know if they see a guy who looks a lot like Brian Laundry, how can they be sure? So we've really narrowed down a lot of characteristics. And in your line of work, I can only imagine that these are extremely helpful. If you zero in, and a lot of people online have done this, if you zero in on the ears of Brian Laundry, they have a very distinctive shape. Let's show that. Let me get the control room to show. They have a very pointed sort of tip to them, but they have those nodules on the side. On both ears, there are these nodules on the cartilage, it seems. And then if you see down below underneath his mustache, there's also what some viewers have thought was a distinctive mole on his, between his cheek and his chin. There's also an interesting bump on his head on the right-hand side. You can see sort of the skin is very uneven above his, what might be his right eyebrow if the picture's not reversed, but it's a very uneven kind of bump to the skin. And maybe most importantly, Richard Frankel, are the tattoos on his hands. You can't always have gloves on your hands, especially when you come indoors, especially when you're eating. And those tattoos are distinctive. There's a leafy pattern on one of the fingers. You can see that right there, clear as a bell. The middle finger has that leafy pattern. And then on the heel of his hand, the outside, there's that mountain pattern on the same hand. Richard, are these just like manna from heaven in trying to track a suspect?
Yeah, right now I don't have the pictures in front of me, but everything that you've described is going to be in the pictures that the FBI and law enforcement has. They're going to take those and they're going to compare them to other pictures, maybe that they already have in their databases, but they're also going to compare them to videos and pictures that come in from around the country where people have said that they've seen this individual. And they're going to be brought back to the FBI lab. They're going to be looked at, and the audio and visual experts if they are similar. you know, you're not going to be able to say in 100% that that is the same person based upon, you know, usually the ears or the head. But if they're similar, that will go to how hard they go at tracking down that individual, that person that might be in those pictures. As far as the tattoos, those are, as you said, manna from heaven. Tattoos are usually fairly identifying. Yes, they can be similar on many different people, but usually they're placed on the hands or on parts of the body in a certain manner. There are certain idiosyncrasies that you'll find in the tattoos. And based upon all that, The investigators will start tracking back again with anyone who comes in, anyone who calls in and says that they've seen the individual. The FBI, law enforcement, if somebody calls in with a lead, they're going to track the lead down. It goes back to what NYPD actually started after 9/11, which is see something, say something. Now it's gone across all law enforcement. Law enforcement has asked the public to help. And if somebody believes, if somebody truly believes that they think they've seen, the fugitive, then they should call that in to the FBI.
Yeah, and that's true.
Ashley,
it's
I'd like to
the
say
fugitive. Real quickly, I've got about 10 seconds. Go ahead, Gil.
Okay, when there's a tip, one tip is going to come in and it's going to be real. And that's how it works. So I worked on these tips and there's a pattern to it, but there's going to be one. They're going to see him going to a deli. They're going to see him sleeping in the car and it's going to come out. And that's how you're going to get this guy. There's going to be a real tip.
That somebody, someone will see that nodule on those ears. It's unmistakable. Or those absolutely critical tattoos. I mean, they are so unique and they're on the hands and you just can't put a sweater over them, you know? So, guys, thank you so much, Richard Frankel and Gil Elba.
Thank you for
so helpful
me.
To get
thank
us
you.
To sort through this. Really appreciate it. We'll have you back as well. You know, these folks, they've crossed the country to scream at the laundries. Take a look at this.
Disgusting. You're
they are angry. But think about this for a moment. How hard would it be to turn your own child into the police? We're going to tell you how hard it is next. So if you have been following this story like we have, moment by moment, there seems like there's a development. And it's 10:46 Eastern Time, and what do you know? There's a new development. This one comes to us via CNN. They have a report tonight that remnants of a recently used campsite have been found at the Florida Reserve. That would be the Carlton Reserve that has been the focus of the Brian Laundrie search. What do you know? Oh, my Lord, because the rest of us have thought this is all a big red herring. No chance Brian Laundrie's over in that reserve. Why are they pumping millions of dollars into the search there? That's what CNN is reporting tonight. That is interesting. We're going to keep an eye on that and bring you any developments when we find them. In the meantime, Chris and Roberta, they have been keeping a very low profile, much lower than the public is prepared to accept. Nobody knows what they truly know about Brian, what he may have done to Gabby Petito, or where he is tonight. The reserve? Maybe. But we do know that their little yellow house has become a magnet for protesters from coast to coast, some even leaving threatening messages. As for what they should be doing about their errant son, Brian, Gabby Petito's dad has some pretty strong thoughts about that and said so to Dr. Phil.
I'm a dad. I make my kids stand up for their decisions. You know, if they make a mistake, I'll help you. I'll walk you through that path. But you're going to own up to your mistake, because that's what a parent does. Not what they're doing. I'm sorry.
But it does get you thinking, doesn't it? Can any of us who is a parent really know how would we react if we were in the same situation? I know you'll say, I would do the right thing. I know you'd say that. But Wyoming is a death penalty state. And before all of this, those laundries were just average American grandparents. Love and morals are two very different things, no matter how tight the spot you are in. Joining us now to help us break this down is forensic psychiatrist Dr. Michael Wellner. Dr. Wellner, it's good to see you. I just would love for you to weigh in on this. How hard is it for us to put ourselves in the laundry's shoes when we all, you know, throw the epithets, do the right thing, turn your son in? How hard is that to do in real in real time?
I think the first place that one starts from a forensic psychiatric perspective is the dynamic within the family. Very often, in our experience, when a fugitive has focus on the family to assist in a search, the family's alienated from that person of interest because of previous antisocial behavior. When you have someone who's close to their loved ones, they're invested in seeing the best in him. And so we don't know what he told them, but what we can expect is that they would be invested in seeing things from his perspective and his account. So while many people around the country and maybe massing on the family grounds and maybe hurling all kinds of anger at the family, we have to remember that they're not necessarily going to see things the way others see them, because they can always say, we know him more than you do. And so he may be guilty of the worst of crimes, of the most depraved of crimes committed on Gabby. But at the same time, if he's been in touch with his family and he's communicated to them an account, they're going to be invested in believing him. And we have to expect that, and we have to respect that, because that's a human nature that comes before any decision to cooperate with law enforcement.
Right. And we have to remember that Gabby's death has not been deemed a murder yet. I suspect it will, but I don't know that. And we only have a bank fraud charge at this point. So we have to be very measured in, you know, what these people are saying, blood on the hands and all the rest. You know, can you tell me, Dr. Wellner, what it takes for a person to pick up in their lives that are so, you know, disconnected to this Florida family and travel, you know, thousands of miles in order to protest, out in front of that house? What does it take inside someone to want to be connected to this story like that when heretofore they weren't?
People are very affected by high exposure crimes, and people can become over-involved just based on their emotional connection to how a case is presented. And I think it happens a lot more frequently in the age of 24-hour news media and in the age of social media, where people develop an interest in a story. They can have a continuous appetite fed, whether it's through social media or through vivid and dramatic news exposure, and people can become over-involved. Forensic mental health professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists remember the story of JonBenet Ramsey, and remember John Mark Carr, who became so over-involved in the case that he ultimately gave a false confession to her murder. And that was a culmination of him just being fixated on the case, participating in chats, and just organizing his life around it. So media has an enormous impact. It can be a great asset to law enforcement. I worked on the Elizabeth Smart case, and Brian David Mitchell would never have been captured if John Walsh weren't calling attention to the unsolved crime and people weren't out looking for the features of someone who might be responsible for the kidnapping. Just as in your last segment, you were talking about Brian's physical features to aid people who might see something and say something. So that's a very positive role that media can play. But at the same time, there are people who watch, get very caught up in the dramatics, and also recognizing that where there are cameras, people go to cameras like bugs go to the light. And they may go to a place that has high exposure, but if the cameras weren't there, they might not be on the doorstep. So I can't really speak to the motives of individuals, but emotions create a pitch. And that goes all the way back to when people were carrying torches and pitchforks to suspects and doing frontier justice.
Yeah. So, Dr. Wellner, I have to fit in a quick break, but I want to ask you after the break about Brian's mental state. If he's been out on the run for this many weeks in this kind of weather, what's happening up here? That's right after this. After the break, back with Dr. Wellner. Back now with forensic psychiatrist Dr. Michael Wellner. Dr. Wellner, what is the toll that is taken on the mental state of a man who's on the run? And if I do my math right, which is hard with the Laundrie's, you know, timeline, it might be that Brian Laundrie's been on the run for almost 3 weeks now.
One important factor that distinguishes this case is that he knows he's being pursued, and he knows that he's known. And it's one thing to be pursued where you feel that you can hide or you can get away from a certain area and you can blend in. But he has to know at this point that this case has been so hyper-exposed that he can't show himself. And that creates a tremendous reinforcement to his isolation. And that isolation over time increases despair, increases desperation. And and what comes with that is risk. And that feeds back to your earlier question about the family. When would a family be inclined to cooperate if they feel that he's at risk to other people while he's on the run, or if he's at risk to himself because his situation becomes increasingly desperate? They wouldn't want their child to kill himself under any circumstances. So, but suicide is a very realistic possibility in a case like this. It often happens. Some of your viewers will remember the Andrew Cunanan case where he shot Gianni Versace, and he was pursued, the object of an intense manhunt. He knew he was being pursued. He knew there was no way out. He knew the evidence tying him to the case was compelling, was overwhelming, and ultimately he did himself in. So that's not surprising, but it's a byproduct of that desperation and a loss of options and isolation.
If Joe Petito gets his way, he wants to see Brian Laundrie brought in alive. Dr. Michael Wellner, thank you so much. It's been good to see you. I hope you'll come back again. And to our viewers, a quick note about tomorrow night. Joe Petito will be here with me. It's our first interview with him since he has discovered that his child is dead, and we have so many questions for him. We will see you right back here tomorrow on Banfield.